welcome to JK It's Magic, a bi-weekly podcast in which two bookish besties read YA fantasy through a critical lens. Why? Because critique is our fangirl love language, and because talking about books is pretty magical. I'm Jessie.
And I'm Kelly.
And today, in our 10th episode,
yay,
we talk about A Reaper at the Gates by Saba Tahir. It's the third book in an Ember and the Ashes series. In this book, we see Laya, Elias, and Helene all separately coming to terms with their newly defined roles in the Empire.
I'm going to start off with the initial reactions this time, breaking the mold. I want to address Saba Tahir directly, and who knows if she'll ever listen to this ever. But Saba, you broke my heart about 9 times in this book, and then somehow made me feel like it was going to be okay at the same time, but also not okay. I'm conflicted. How do you do it? You made me care about characters that I also found quite loathsome before, so that's pretty masterful. Cough. Helene. And all that to say, I loved A Reaper at the Gates, and not necessarily because it was action-packed, which it was, but because of the obvious thought and care that went into the character development, and I'm really excited for book 4.
I really enjoyed this book. It was interesting to see all of our characters come into their own separately, but I am terrified about what's going to happen in the next book.
She's savage.
I'm scared it's Game of Thrones all over again. Like, everyone's going to die. I'm also super disappointed that I have to wait until next year to see how all of it ends. That's me assuming that the 4th book is the last book in this series. Time to talk about all things world building in Through the Wardrobe. Similar to A Torch Against the Night, when Mammy Ryla tells Elias' story, Musa believes Laya's story is important to forming a resistance. On page 130, he says, "First, you have to be someone worth listening to, someone worth following. For that to happen, the scholars in Edissa and in the camps need to know who you are and what you've done. And that means that for now, all I need is your story." I think we're supposed to see that storytelling is really important to these communities and to forming a resistance. But we also see Karis using the same tactics to get the gens on her side and then the plebeians.
We do see narrative used to persuade / manipulate, regardless of your political leanings.
Right. And I thought that was really interesting, especially because we see the library burned down. Not okay with that. Fuck that. Who burns down a library?
That was one of the most tragic parts.
I was like, the library. But there's a lot of oral traditions going on throughout the story, even with in different groups of people.
Well, the augurs with the prophecy, mm-hmm. That's also important.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. We'll see
where it goes in the future. No more augurs, I guess.
Yeah. No, they did.
No more prophecies then?
I think the prophecies still exist if they were recorded.
Yeah, but no future prophecies?
Probably not. I also really enjoyed seeing the djinn through Elias's eyes, because up until that point, I was having a hard time imagining what they looked like and what their society looked like. And when we see Elias gets access to that when Moth, we don't know. There's no way to know. Gives him a flashback, and he gets to see what their whole society looked like. And the djinn seem really strange and beautiful. And I was surprised to learn that there were many soul catchers, not just one. And now I think the entire fictional world makes a lot more sense now that I see how important the djinn were in keeping balance between the living and the dead. So this big picture narrative and fight that's going on makes a lot more sense to me.
Yeah, I think it also makes sense in that we see like more magical creatures in the beginning. Like we see a very few of them, and throughout the story we see more and more of them. I think that makes more sense when we think about like people breaking out of the waiting place. That's what it's called, the waiting place. And all these different kinds of what I was thinking of as spirits, but really they're magical creatures becoming more and more part of this world. That was really cool. Little flame balls of children. That was a weird picture in my head to imagine, like little kids running around, but they're also on fire.
That also kind of seems apropos for what children are like in human life.
That's true. They just go around raging and causing all kinds of destruction.
Little mayhem creatures.
Little hellions. Those are children in real life. I like throughout the story that Sabatahir wrote the scholars as suffering because of the sins of their ancestors, but at the same time, this modern day scholars don't seem to remember why that they are the ones who are suffering. And I think this comes up a lot with, obviously, Cain knows, the Augur knows why this is all happening, but he doesn't tell anyone. It's real shitty.
It is. And there is this collective amnesia on the scholars' part because they don't understand that they were once the oppressors.
Right.
And now they are the oppressed. So I'm interested to see how this dynamic gets resolved.
Yeah, and I wonder what the effect of this, all of the Augurs being dead, will have on this. Like, will the Nightbringer tell the scholars what they've done and why they're the ones who are now suffering? That's going to be a hard pill to swallow.
Or will he just exterminate them all?
That is my fear, but I don't know. I think no, in that Sabatahir wouldn't kill off everyone, but I'm also not 100% sure that she wouldn't.
No one is safe. No one is safe.
Please do not kill Laia or Elias. That's all I ask. or Harper. Or Toss. I have a lot of requests.
Wands out. This is the segment when we discuss all things magic. I was interested in this dichotomy, combination, interaction between moth/mouth versus physical magic. And we see Elias distinguish between them. That's when we first see this difference. I'm wondering, is mouth some sort of primordial magic, more like Merzost in the Grishaverse, like the creation-y sort of magic or death magic, versus more superficial kinds of physical magic, which would be like Helene's healing power or Laia's invisibility?
I was thinking the exact same thing. All of a sudden in this story, Elias seemed to talk about how his wind walking was a type of physical magic, and I didn't understand / I was unsure of what the other type of magic was supposed to be. I'm wondering now if it's the magic that is innate in those magical creatures, like the Efrits and the Wraiths and the Djinn. They are like born of magic. They come, like, I think, like you're saying, they're like from some magic before time beginning.
That's what mouth seems like to me. Moth, I have no idea. There's no way to know. That's what it seems more like to me, is this very like elemental, like the beginning of all things, the essence of all things. And it requires this big sacrifice from Elias, supposedly. And versus these other kinds of magic that are tangentially related to it. Maybe they're like offshoots of it, right. But it's not that like deep wellspring.
Right. But where does it come from?
It just is, maybe.
Just is. Yeah, I don't know. I feel really bad. I just want to say that I feel super bad for Elias at this point, because Mouth, whatever his name is, has completely taken over Elias's body and is just doing whatever he wants with Elias.
Elias is definitely more like a vessel.
Right.
Which is something I wanted to segue into, that we, in this book, in A Reaper at the Gates, we see more how the waiting place actually works, how what Mouth's role is, and the sacrifices that the soul catcher has to make. On page 40, Shiva says to Elias, "I understand your pain, truly, but for us, Elias, duty must reign over all else, desire, sadness, loneliness. Love cannot live here. You chose the waiting place, and the waiting place chose you. Now you must give yourself to it, wholly, body and soul." And my question is, do we see Elias giving up feelings/emotions on this path to joining with this primordial magic? Or does Elias just feel differently, as in non-humanly?
I don't know. He keeps trying to make this connection between giving up his feelings and being a mask. So he says, like, I have to become the mask Elias, as opposed to, I guess, non-mask Elias, I guess, tribesperson Elias. I think that would be the distinction, maybe. So I don't think he feels differently, because you can sometimes see him trying to, like, fight with Mouth, trying to, like, tell him, like, don't leave Laia at the edge of the forest, you know, like, I love her. But I don't know. I think he's, like, pushed them aside in order to do something, and that's when Mouth comes in and, like, kind of takes control of him.
When I was reading it, I thought that, oh, he's shutting his emotions down completely. But then when I was trying to think, oh, maybe we could think about it a different way, that he's just not feeling like a human anymore. He's feeling in this totally other, like capital O, mm-hmm. sort of way.
Right.
He transcended into this other, to connecting with this magical force. Right. And now he feels, but just not humanly.
Yeah. Maybe that is. I don't know. It's kind of a weird thing, since you see him wrestling with his own emotions, but at the same time trying to like push them aside. It's a strange thing he's working through.
Because it seemed like Shiva had feelings.
Right.
They just weren't human ones.
Right. But she seemed to also still have some connection with Elias, like in a sisterly, brotherly, familial way.
Which, tangent, I thought was super cute, and I love their relationship, and I'm sad she died.
I'm only kind of sad she died.
Okay. You're more callous than me.
Oh, yeah.
We knew that, though.
Yeah.
I'm also not totally convinced that love and the waiting place are mutually exclusive, because there used to be a bunch of soul catchers who had families and children, and we saw them in that flashback that I just mentioned. The Nightbringer was one of those beings. So I don't see any reason to believe why this would be impossible for Elias, but maybe it's not possible now. Maybe it is eventually. Or maybe it has to be that sort of like non-human type of love affection between two non-human beings. I don't know.
I'm wondering if part of the reason that Mal thinks that Elias can't, like, love can't be a part of this is because it seems to have been partly Shiva's relationship with Cain that caused the downfall of the djinn. And so
I didn't even think about that.
I don't know if it was like a romantic relationship or not, but it was some kind of relationship. So I wonder if Mouth feels like the waiting place and the djinn being captured is a result of having feelings, and so that's why Mouth, he, it, they, I'm not sure what they,
let's not gender it,
yeah, they, that's why they think that love can't be a part, like feelings can't be a part of being a soul catcher now.
I'm curious to see what Elias's character arc is going to do in book four. We're not done, I'm sure.
No. And I'm wondering if we'll see more of what that relationship with Shiva and Cain and the Nightbringer looked like. Because we don't really get much backstory on that dynamic.
Because if the whole point is to restore balance, then it would maybe seem that what's going on with math, whatever, is also maybe extreme and out of balance. And that's like necessary. So maybe emotions are able to happen, like I said, eventually, but just not in this process of restoring balance.
Yeah, we'll see, hopefully. Now that the djinn have returned, do you think some of them will become soul catchers again, since that's what a lot of them seem to do, instead of just being one person?
I don't know. If it were me, I would maybe want a little bit of vengeance first.
And I'm the callous one. Do you think Elias will need to find someone else to be soul catcher as a safety precaution in case he dies?
Is he mortal or not? I don't know. It seems like he can still die.
Well, they say he can still die, but then Mouth seems to insinuate that he'll be soul catcher forever.
Unless he dies?
I'm like guessing an elf? Unless he's killed.
Kind of like elves. Technically, you're immortal, except that
you can be killed.
Yeah.
I just don't understand what their plan is if Elias dies.
I think he needs to go start recruiting, because apparently there were a lot of soul catchers before, when the djinn were around and free last time.
Right.
So I'm a feeling that it's just going to get bloodier. Thanks, Karis. So there's going to be a lot more ghosts. I think he needs to have some help.
My prediction is that Lyle will also become a soul catcher.
And then they can be together forever?
Yeah. I just want them together so badly.
You're so into the ship.
I know.
You mentioned this a little bit before, but in general, I got this sense in this book that magic has become a much more normalized part of the world as the series has progressed. Hardly anyone knew about Ifrits, ghouls, or wraiths, wights. I can't remember what they're called.
I think those are two different things. And so, they're both in this story.
Yeah. And hardly anyone knew what they were in A Torch Against the Night. And now we have an invading army that uses ghosts on a mass scale as weapons. And so Saba Tahir orchestrated this shift masterfully, in my opinion, because it was subtle and it seemed very natural rather than all of a sudden going, oh yeah, there's magic everywhere now and it's actually been here the whole time. But it's true that magic has been here the whole time. It was woven into the fabric of the fictional world, but it had been buried. And this slow process of uncovering just seemed very well written to me.
Yeah, I think we even talked about it when we talked about An Ember in the Ashes, how there wasn't actually that much magic in the book for a fantasy story. It was kind of, you know, I don't know, it just not much, you know, there. So it was interesting to see like that come around like full circle. And now there's so much magic and there's so many things going on and everyone has magical powers.
And we don't just have humans anymore. We have magical beings.
Yeah. So I really like how it has increased throughout the story, but the shift has been subtle and not jarring at all.
Like a gradual crescendo.
Yeah. Pretty impressive, Saba Tahir. You're a good writer.
Wands away.
Now we're going to talk about conflict, villains, and good versus evil in a segment we're calling Get Me Kylo Ren. I did not think I could hate Karras any more than I already did. I'm not sure I have the words to describe how terrible of a person she is, and we don't even see that much of her in this book, and I hate her more than before. She's out of control.
Out of control is the perfect way to describe her. I really appreciated how we got more of Karras's backstory. I'm a sucker for villain backstories. We know this already. But particularly what was going on with her tattoo. This is it's so messed up. It's like systematically killing your lovers, murderers, and proceeding to add the letters to your always victorious tattoo, which is like a neck. Is it a neck tattoo? I don't know where it was.
I assumed it was like one of those collarbone tattoos.
Oh, yeah. Probably. But I'm hesitant to think she's just evil out of the blue. Like, I don't really think that happens. So I wonder what else happened to Karras to make her so power hungry and tyrannical.
I'm guessing a lot of it had to do with that relationship between her mother and herself. And when her mom died and then her dad was there for like 2 seconds and was like, peace out.
Because the Wisp is that's her, Karras's mom.
Yeah.
That's Elias's grandma. Totally going to hear more about that.
I don't think I realized that her lovey was
her
Karras.
Kid.
Okay, I didn't put those two things together.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I'm like, girl, get it together. Like, not everyone who loses a parent goes on like a murderous rampage. Like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Yeah, you're totally right. It's not an excuse.
No,
I want to see more where this goes. I'm looking forward to book 4.
Yeah, I'm wondering if we'll get more of her relationship with Elias's and Avitas's father, because something's going on there.
They're only half brothers.
Don't really understand.
I don't think they have the same father.
No, they have the same father, not the same mother. Karras isn't Harper's mom.
She's not?
No.
I missed that.
They have the same dad.
I missed that completely.
It was really cool because I was like, they're half brothers. And you're like, whole brothers. And then we found other half brothers.
Well, you'll have to fill me in.
Okay.
I don't remember when that happened. She adopted him or some shit?
Yeah, she's taking care of her former lover's child.
Okay. But by turning him into an assassin.
But we also don't really know that much about Avitas. Like, hardly anything. So I don't really know.
I don't know.
Either way.
Karras. Villain extraordinaire. Love how she's a woman, though. It's not just a dude being a bad guy.
Also, watch Sharp Objects if you're really into that. Women as villains. There's a shit ton of them in that show. Probably also read the book. I didn't read it, so I don't want to recommend it. but also read the book, because Gillian Flynn seems pretty awesome. She writes really good women villains. Surprising ones. Kane.
Dot, dot, dot.
He was the one who started all the problems for the Empire by stealing the knowledge of the Djinn and imprisoning them. And then he has the audacity to, like, make all these, like, I don't want to say predictions. What are they? Prophecies about, like, Elias and Helene and Laia and not tell them the whole truth. And that's some bullshit. I really do not like Kane. I'm glad he's dead.
I'm confused about this because he was a scholar king.
Right.
So was it a scholar empire first? And then, like, where did the marshals come from? How did they take over and enslave the scholars? Like, IDK.
I don't know either. Maybe we'll learn that. There's so many things where I'm like, we'll learn in the next book.
And if he's a scholar king who's been playing the long game, trying to like have his three chosen ones millennia down the road, finally like beat the Nightbringer and win, quote unquote. I don't know. Like, what? Like, why were you? That means that you helped the Empire enslave the scholars.
Because people?
Yeah, you've been around for 1,000 years. Like, what the fuck is your end game? Like, what are you doing?
I really don't understand, because why did you start this war in the first place? Like, I really don't.
There are gaps in our knowledge, and I wish they didn't burn the library so that we could learn about it.
Well, Lya does have that one book about the augurs, right?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we'll learn more from that in the next
one. That'd be cool if Saba Tahir did like a spinoff, kind of like how J.K. Rowling did Tales of Beedle the Bard.
Oh, like where we learn like the stories from that book that Lya has.
Yeah.
I would like that.
I think that'd be cool.
Yeah.
On page 367, we get the revelation that Marcus isn't quote unquote crazy when he explains to Helene, "My brother speaks to me from beyond death, Shrike." And I read this as like an invitation to consider mental illness differently and almost to consider what wisdom neurodivergent people have to offer. So if we just write people off as like hearing voices or whatever, I don't, that's not to me the most compassionate or empathetic way to see that. I think it's closed-minded, I think, and very centering ability in neurotypical people.
And it's interesting, especially in this story where Helene knows she has magical powers and all that's going on, that they wouldn't think that Marcus has some ability to also do something magical.
They just write him off as erratic and insane.
I think part of it might be because he does really bad things that seem to make no sense to anyone, like, you know, just trying to kill and rape everyone. Okay, not everyone, just the women. But I don't know. I thought it was kind of strange.
It added this nuance to the character that I enjoyed and that I thought was kind of lacking. And I just thought it was interesting how it almost gives credence to the hearing voices. It makes it real to other people.
Right. Yeah, because once they told him, no, sorry. Once Marcus said that he could hear his brother, Zach, talking to him, people, at least Helene, stopped writing him off as a crazy person. Like, she believed that that could be true.
So, yeah. So to me, that was just kind of an invitation to maybe just stop writing off people who are neurodivergent.
Yeah. Also, I do feel like the smallest amount bad for Marcus.
Shocker.
I know.
From you?
I mean, he's a terrible person and he deserved to die. And I'm glad he's dead. But him being separated from his brother and all the things that happened to him before he became the king, like that's a tough life. That poor kid. Help people when they're kids instead of waiting until they're adults.
And don't turn them into assassins when they're six.
Or ever.
Or ever.
Okay, like, let's talk about the Nightbringer.
I have to.
I'm not sure exactly how we're supposed to feel about him. He's attempting to free his people who have been imprisoned, similar to Lya attempting to free the scholars from their enslavement. Seeing the story of what happened to the djinn through Elias, I feel bad for the djinn, but at the same time, I think they're going about things the wrong way, because one of the things that seem really important to the Nightbringer is getting revenge, whereas Lya doesn't seem concerned with revenge, even though she definitely could become bitter in the same way.
I'm similarly conflicted about the Nightbringer, mainly because I don't think we can 100% discount militancy as a tactic to create change.
True.
And to overthrow oppressive systems. Diversity of tactics, I mean, it's like has worked.
Right.
Not that there haven't been awful consequences, but like for real, it's effective. And also giving up privilege, which was gained through violent means to begin with, will inevitably be painful. But will it be / should it be like genocide level painful? I don't know. And I'm not sure that's for the oppressor to decide.
Right. And yeah, especially I think the hard part about it especially is because over those thousand years where the marshals have been in charge and the scholars have been enslaved, and part of me feels like, isn't that punishment enough for them?
Which is Lya's point.
Right.
Point.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm so, like, I know he's a villain, but at the same time, I feel bad for him. Like, he lost his whole family and all of his people. I just don't know how to feel.
And I think this gets to that we'll see more of his story, which is another thing that I wanted to bring up, that I wonder how his name, Mihira, the beloved, will come into play. I think that maybe Laia will be instrumental in turning things around somehow, or maybe changing this being somehow. I don't know. Shifting its perspective. And Cook is the one who underscores the importance of knowing an enemy's story. And so we also see that when she's asking Laia to learn about Karis when she sacrifices herself. Oh my God, so sad.
Yeah.
But necessary.
But also, I was, as I texted you yesterday, I was real glad I called it last book that Cook was Laia's mom. I felt so proud of myself.
You did.
Also, I didn't think about this until right this second, how they keep talking about the djinn and wraiths and ghouls as fae. And isn't that like a thing in fairy folklore, like how knowing their name like you gives you control over them? Is that a thing?
It sounds like a thing.
I think it's a thing. I'll look it up. But yeah, I'm interested to see how that, like, knowing the Nightbringer's name will come into play.
I put this note in here because I want to see what your reaction is. Helene, is it a shift from antagonist to protagonist in this novel? Jesse, how do you feel about it?
I mean, yes, you are correct. It is. And I, like, low-key hate Saba Tahir for doing this to me because I, like, have started, like, Helene is still a terrible person and a white feminist, but she's, like, maybe some growth there.
Significant character development?
Yes.
But I'm ready for more. Ready for her to completely renounce her white feminism.
Yes.
We interrupt these deep cuts to bring you Show Us Your Fakes. Which character do you think deserves their own storyline? Let us know by finding us on Twitter or Instagram at JKMagicPod. Harper. Where my fix at?
I don't know. Let's have them.
I should please. Google it. I haven't even Googled it.
Yeah, there's an app for that. A few of them.
Also, Musa. I liked him.
I did too. And for maybe like a few chapters, I thought, oh man, are we going to get a new love triangle with Musa and Laia and Elias? Like, I'm not really here for another love triangle there. And then he kept referring to Laia as like sister. So I don't think we're going to have
that. I liked how that wasn't even on the table.
I was glad because I was disappointed for a few minutes.
But like, how fucked up is it that that's what we always look for? Like, I hate that I'm conditioned.
I know.
To want, to like default that I want, especially my women characters, to have love interests.
I know. The problem is I just love romance. Like, I love love so much. I'm so callous, but I'm also like, oh, let them be together. Let them be happy. Okay, back to the deep cuts. Because just as one does not simply walk into Mordor, one does not simply read fantasy without talking about representations of race, class, and gender, this is our segment about power and bodies and how they relate. Let's start with gender today. Helene is constantly comparing herself to Laia because she's jealous of the relationship between Elias and Laia. And I am real tired of it.
I honestly didn't pick up on this in the book.
There were a couple times where she, where her and Laia were like near each other and she's talking about like how beautiful Laia is and her connection with Elias. And I was just like, dude, he doesn't like you. It's not a big deal. You don't have to hate Laia because of that.
I thought that was a much bigger part of Helene's character arc in books 1 and 2.
What was that?
The being jealous of Laia.
Right.
Because of Elias. Because we got Harper.
I know. But then she also pushed him away and I was real sad for him.
So many feelings about that.
But I mean, don't like make out with someone you don't want to. That's like...
Oh, she totally wanted to.
I know she wanted to, but I'm saying don't if you don't want to.
Yeah. You have more to say about Helene?
I have so much to say about Helene, even though a little bit hater. Helene is looked down on as Bloodstrike, especially by the djinns, because she's a woman.
But they don't seem to look down on Karis for being a woman. I think they're just scared shitless of Karis.
Yeah. I mean, she is she is by any means necessary going to get what she wants to get. So I'd be scared of her too. But I also would have killed her like two books ago.
This quote stuck out to me. It's in Helene's exposition at the end of the novel, right when she decides to partner with Lya. She says, "Curse this world for what it does to the mothers, for what it does to the daughters. Curse it for making us strong through loss and pain, our hearts torn from our chests again and again. Curse it for making us endure." It's on page 448. Just wanted to put that on the table.
That was really, I feel like a little bad for Helene for like watching her mom be killed and then Lya the same thing. And I'm wondering if that'll like bridge this gap between the two of them in the next book from, you know, suffering loss in similar ways. And Lya is going to get a teacher to teach her how to fight, who's a woman.
I'm excited for how that relationship's going to develop.
Me too. I feel a little like Cassian and Feyre. So, like they're buds, you know?
They are.
So I'm not sure exactly how to feel about this. Let me just start with that, because Kane's a dude and he's calling out Helene on her white feminism. So I'm kind of like, good for you, Kane, even though I hate you and you're the worst. But also, like, white feminism's worse still. On page 70, Kane says, "You live and breathe and eat and sleep on the backs of those less fortunate. Your entire existence is due to the oppression of those you view lesser."
Fuck yes. But also pretty rich coming from a dude that orchestrated the rise of an oppressive and genocidal empire,
yeah,
slash committed genocide and imprisoned an entire like species.
Maybe we're supposed to see this as him like learning his lesson over 1,000 years. Like, man, I really fucked up.
It took you long enough. Shit.
Yeah, way too long. And there's a lot of growth with Helene in this book. I didn't think it would be possible, but she seems to like kind of come around at the end a little bit. Maybe.
There's one other thing that I want to talk about with Helene, and I'm putting this under gender because it has to do with a lot of Helene's privilege and her white feminism, but it also, like, the conversation extends beyond just this one category. But just before Helene gives the Nightbringer her mask, he says to her, "Your love of your people runs deep. It was nurtured through all the years spent at Blackcliff. It grew deeper when you saw the suffering in Navium and helped the children in the infirmary. Deeper when you healed your sister and imbued your nephew with the love you have of your country. Deeper still when you saw the strength of your countrymen as they prepared for the siege. It fused with your soul when you fought for them on the walls of Antium. And now it culminates in your sacrifice for them." It's page 429 to 430. And Helene, for me, super needs to work on what this like love of her people and country actually looks like, because it's been a love of people like her, read high class white marshals. And for this just like really hits home, because and really brought up for me the fact that like ignorant and unquestioning patriotism does more harm than good. I'm convinced of this. And what for me I find much more persuasive is James Baldwin says in Notes from a Native Son. This is a quote. "I love America more than any other country in the world, and, exactly for this reason, I insist on the right to criticize her perpetually. I think all theories are suspect, that the finest principles may have to be modified, or may even be pulverized by the demands of life, and that one must find, therefore, one's own moral center, and move through the world hoping that this center will guide one aright." By which he means a left.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that I love America more than any other country in the world, but I totally agree with this, that if an expression of love is holding it to the highest standard and demanding that it be more inclusive and more equitable. And I really hope that Helene starts moving in this direction. I honestly think that's where she's going. That's kind of where I see this trajectory moving, is shedding the white feminism and moving towards like waking up to a more inclusive and equitable standard. What did you think?
Oh, I 100% agree. My guess is that by forming a relationship with Lya in the next book, she'll see it'll humanize the scholars for her, which in turn will humanize all the other people in their world for her. But I'm not a very patriotic person, and by that I mean I'm not at all. So I'm kind of like, yeah, who cares about your love for your country? Like, it's the people who matter.
But for Helene, it's her people.
Yeah.
Like, only her class. Only her race.
Right.
That's it.
Yeah. I don't know. The problem for me is, I think, if you love something, and I I hold this true for people as well. You have to be willing to not criticize them, but hold them to a higher standard and call them out on their bullshit. And Helene is not willing to do that at the moment, but hopefully she does in the future.
And I think why I like Helene, just like in spite of all the odds, like how did you do it, Sabah Tahir? But is because I notice something of myself in her, right? This like not really realizing the part you were playing in oppression, essentially, until you do.
Right.
And then, but that's like my shit to deal with. Mm-hmm. Like I have to process that. And then obviously like go forward trying to do less harm.
Right. And I think maybe sometimes myself especially forget when we're reading this book that Helene's probably like 20 years old. It's hard to imagine that she's that young because she's a fucking assassin and like out there on the battlefield murdering people like way better than like a bunch of other people. But she's like 20 years old. And so you have to have like we have to give her the room to like grow up.
Let's talk race/class because I think they are very intertwined, especially with all the slavery questions that are happening in this book. The Empire is over-policing the tribes and imprisoning them and then enslaving them. And I thought, huh, this is exactly how our modern prison system works in the United States of America.
Exactly. I think even in the book before this, Gibran talks about how they've taken the scholars, they're coming for us next. He's 100% correct about that. The mm-hmm. tribes people are the next slaves.
Yep. And they justify slavery through prison.
Right.
Well, they just enslave the scholars, but it seems like with the tribes people, they're actually like trying to make the excuse of charging them with crimes and then turning them into slaves.
Yeah, exactly. And then we see Livia free the scholar slaves. Great. But only the ones who make it out of Antium.
The other ones either are dead because they didn't make it out of Antium, or they're living in parts of the empire controlled by Karis and therefore still enslaved.
Or I'm going to guess Karis might kill them all since she's working for the Nightbringer.
That's true. That could happen.
I just realized that we're going to have like a woman in power either way. Karis is the person in power of the like, I'm going to say like the fake new state. And Livia is kind of in charge of the new empire because her son is so young.
But also I'm not on board with the keep your son on the throne, maintain the empire crap.
No, like, that's some bullshit.
No thanks. Oh, I have no idea how dark and twisty book four is going to get. But when you were saying Karis might just kill all the scholars, I was thinking, are we going to go down like into extermination camp territory? Like it could get really dark.
My guess is yes. The books have gotten progressively darker, so I don't have... they're not high hopes that things are going to get better anytime soon.
Another question I had is, are the Karkans... Karkowns? No way to know. A whole different race? I was getting some real strong Game of Thrones wildling king over the... wall, over the wall, beyond the wall, king beyond the wall vibes from the Karkans because it sounds like they're dressed in I don't know. I was kind of conflicted about how they were presented.
It was strange because at first I thought, well, they're going to be a different race. They're obviously going to be like darker, but then they describe them as having very pale skin. And I'm guessing they live where it snows a lot.
But I thought they were from the south.
Maybe their south is cold.
That could be.
It's a magical world. I don't know.
I don't know.
But also they were painting their faces with blue?
With woad, which is like what the Celtic tribes used to do.
Yeah, so all I could imagine was Braveheart.
Yeah, totally.
And I was like...
Or like that bad King Arthur movie that Keira Knightley was in.
Oh, you know, I saw it when I was real young, so I was like, cool, I love Keira Knightley. yeah, but that is what I imagined. So I don't know. But it's hard because Helene is pale with blonde hair.
Yeah, I was thinking the Grimar or whatever was like Mance Rayder. Yeah. I don't know. I was seeing this parallel all over the place. And I liked that we got introduced to another force. I hope we learn more about them and what they want.
Right.
Seems like a super patriarchal society because he was calling the Bloodshrike like I'm talking to your master as if she were enslaved to the man next to her.
And he sacrificed women and children to, like, use their ghosts to fight against the Empire. What the fuck is wrong with that guy? I mean,
technically it worked. Like, he called the ghosts.
He did. He's got a lot of magical powers. Now I'm a little concerned about...
It's a bunch of warlock priests, right, is what I heard.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. From the book, right?
Yes.
And then Helene makes some point that the Nightbringer must have taught them that, I'm sure. This is all part of the Nightbringer's long game, which then obviously makes me not want to sympathize with the Nightbringer. Like we said, I'm conflicted about it.
Yeah.
But I hope that we learn more, get a little bit more of a glimpse, speak of what this people is like.
Right.
I'm sure we will, because we'll like see inside of Antium while it's being occupied.
I'm gonna guess that maybe Laia and Helene, and maybe Elias if he gets his shit together, will try and free Antium of, you know, the people who have taken them over.
I'm sure,
but I don't know.
But I hope we go beyond just restoring the previous oppressive system.
Yeah, like, do they really need a king or a queen, or, you know, can't we just like get a democracy going or something? Democratic socialism, that's what I'm talking about.
Right, or like a straight up Marxist state.
Oh, yeah, something. But you probably don't need like the regency.
No thanks. Finally, it's time for Shipwrecked, a segment about sexuality, asexuality, sex, romance, and relationships. And sometimes we take liberties and do some shipping of our own. My main question, is the Alaya ship gone forever?
I surely hope not. I just want them to be together and happy. I don't know.
Pretty clean break.
Yeah, but Laia was like, she was like, can't forget what Elias told me. Like, he loves me even if I'm different. And I was just like, oh, my heart was breaking.
And technically, Elias didn't throw the bracelet on the ground. He kept the bracelet in his pocket.
So something in him is like, I still love her. Keep them together, please. I feel really bad for Harper in this story, and I don't even like Helene enough yet to want her to be happy, but I really like Harper and want him to be happy, which means I have to want Helene to be happy as well.
What I appreciate about this ship, which I'm all on board for, I ship it so hard, is that she is really the dominant force in this dynamic. Like, she is way more powerful than him, and he seems totally consenting to that. I mean, technically that's how like their military works or whatever she's actually a part of.
I think that's part of the reason she has the power, because she turns to the, like, to become the Bloodshrike every time like he gets too close and reminds him that she's actually the one in charge.
But I appreciate his it seems like a devotion to her and not necessarily wanting her to be anything else.
Right.
Like, he fell in love with her as the Bloodshrike, if he's in love with her. I don't know. Maybe he's just lustful. Who knows? Who says lustful?
I don't know. 'Cause I was like, maybe he just wants to smash. Like, that's fine. I get it. Well, not really, because I don't like Helene, but like, that's fine too. You know, do what you gotta do.
I just appreciate that the power dynamic is skewed in favor of the not man.
Yeah, I think go for it. She should be in charge. I mean, I still hate her, but
I predict that by the end of book four, you will be less anti-Helene.
I 100% agree with you. I think I will, because I'm already moving towards liking her more.
You're going to fight. You're not going to like it.
No, I'm not, but I'm also going to be happy that everyone's happy in the end and safe and whatever.
And that she woke the fuck up.
Yeah. You know, I think people should be allowed to go through their shit and grow up. So once she does, I'm sure I'll like her just fine. I can be forgiving sometimes. So we find out in this book that Dex is gay? We didn't know that before, right?
I don't think so.
Okay. And he's hiding it. And I guess it's not really surprising to me that this society is homophobic, but I like that Helene is willing to say she accepts Dex for who he is.
I agree. Yes. But, which I'm sure we saw coming. Yes, but again, we have to settle for a side character being gay and the main ships are hetero. I'm just like, why? And of course it's better than nothing. Of course. But I just don't want to settle for half measures anymore. And although I kind of get it, because I imagine heterosexual authors generally might be worried about writing LGBTQIA+ main characters specifically for fear of fucking up. Like, I get it. Okay, fair. But sensitivity readers exist for a reason. And I'm not just calling out like Sabatier on this. Definitely not. It's like all over fantasy, especially YA fantasy. But like then again, it's hard because I definitely don't think heterosexual, allosexual, cisgender authors should co-opt the stories of LGBTQIA+ people. And I don't know if writing fantasy potentially gives authors more space to write diverse characters in more generous and thoughtful ways, even if the authors themselves don't identify with those different, I don't know, ways of being. So I have questions and not answers.
Yeah, I agree. I'm ready for us to read some gay books.
And we have a gay book coming. We have a bisexual book coming up.
Isn't this one? Like, our next book?
Is our next book gay?
I think it is.
It might be.
I think it's gay. And then the one after that, too.
I hope it's the gayest.
I hope so, too. But I 100% agree with you. Like, we are always getting side characters. And especially in this book, like, Dex isn't even a character I feel particularly, like, connected with in any way, shape, or form. He's just there.
I really hope he gets more visibility in the next, I think that's probably totally possible.
Yeah. But Sarah J. Maas is the same thing, and I won't spoil it for anyone who hasn't read it, so I won't tell you who or what goes on, but like, we get a gay side character, one that I felt kind of connected to, but at the same time, it's like, why can't we have gay main characters?
And I don't know if this is the next, like, I don't know what the next step is that for, like, I obviously think more LGBTQIA+ people should be makers and publishing things.
Definitely.
At all levels of publishing. But at the same time, I feel like it's an issue when only people who identify that way prioritize those sorts of stories.
Well, in this case, even Sabatier is writing characters who are white. She's not white. Like,
yeah, that's true.
You know? And I think we read What If It's Us. I don't think Becky Albertalli is gay. I mean, obviously, I can't speak from, like, experience from like the community standpoint, but her gay characters don't seem to be offensive in any way
or like exploitative.
Yeah, exactly. And I think all of her books have gay characters, gay main characters. Like, so you can do it. It's possible. Just do it.
I hope that that's where we move forward, like with YA publishing in general.
Yeah, I hope so too. But I think you're right. Sometimes I think it does have to start with people from that community, so that other people feel comfortable. And I think part of that's a money thing, because until I think it's profitable, publishers don't want to publish it.
It's an industry.
It is, and it's bullshit. We should read more indie authors.
We really should. And that's, like, again, I feel conflicted about this, because then that just means that once LGBTQIA+ stories become something to make money off of,
right,
that's when you get more of them. So, like,
we see the same thing with POC characters. Like, until publishing thought it could be profitable for them, they weren't doing it. And now that it is, they're like, yeah, let's publish all these books by POC authors and about POC people. And I think that's a great thing, but it shouldn't, you know, just be because a bunch of white ladies in publishing are like, let's make some money.
Fucking capitalism.
I know. I say that because 88% of the people working in publishing are white women. If you didn't know.
I think if there were a little less white feminism, then it'd be better. But also, like, I'm not striving to, in the neoliberal sense, to, like, just make the industry better.
Right.
Ugh.
I know. I'm conflicted.
Me too.
Well, we got a gay character. So we can be happy for that.
Totally.
Even if it was small.
Sexy times. Saba reined it in at so many different points. Just the short kiss scenes. We got a little fade out with Laya and Elias. I was like, I was hoping for that scene.
Not a fade out even. Like, let's stop this. Like, in the middle of their soon-to-be sexy time, she was like, wait a second. Elias realizes this is real. He's like, never mind.
And they're trying to use him. The gym are trying to use him. That was messed up.
Yeah, it was.
But the one that upset me the most was at the end. The Harper and Helene scene at the end. Like,
That one wasn't even most upsetting to me.
I know.
Elias one.
I just felt this tension. It's been there the whole time. It's been there the whole time. And Helene, if anyone needs some sexual release, it is that person.
Yeah. I mean, I just want, like, can you just give us books with sex in them? What is with this? I think I've read too much Sarah J. Maas, and now I'm just like, and then like adult romance novels that I'm just like, where is the sex in this book?
Well, because the people at Blackcliff were all like having sex with the prostitutes.
Yeah. Yeah. Helene encourages Dex to go be with male prostitutes somewhere. I don't remember where they are when this happens.
Yeah, that's like, true.
You're encouraging this. Like, have some sex yourself, girl.
And also, I it's kind of like a YA in general, right? The talking about sex and not really like showing what consensual sex can look like.
Yeah. Something that's real important, author. Show, don't tell.
Selfishly, me. For the sexy times also.
Yeah, but also it's like the rule of writing. So like, show me, don't tell me.
Speaking of writing.
Now we're going to talk about writing style, narration, characterization, plot structure, and basically whatever else comes to mind in a segment called Kill Your Darlings. The book starts and ends with the Nightbringer's POV. And I was really surprised when I started reading to have his point of view. By the end, I was like, yeah, okay, that's fine. But I think it was important.
It's important because I think it's shepherding us as the readers into this much larger framework of the large-scale conflict that's going on. So it made sense to me.
Agreed.
But it makes sense to me now talking to you after I finished it. I don't know if I put that together while I was actually reading it.
I think I did because I was like, how much money do I have left to read before the acknowledgments, you know? And I was like, oh, Nightbringer again. That's weird. I also read this book in like 3 days.
By this point in the series, I was used to each chapter ending on a cliffhanger and switching to another POV, so I didn't find it as frustrating by book three. And while reading this book, I was also much more invested in each of the distinct storylines than I had been before. Like before I was like, meh, Helene. But for this book, each storyline was so interesting and tense that I was looking forward to switching and seeing how that picking up with the one that we left behind previously.
Right. And I think some of that is due to the fact that none of our characters are together anymore in this book, at least for most of the time. So we really get to see them each doing something very different. So while it was a cliffhanger each time, and I'm like when Laya opens the door and she's like, someone's in the room. And I'm like, well, who the fuck is it? And I had to wait like chapters to find out, like 2 chapters. It wasn't that long. But I think it makes it like more interesting when they're not all together in their different POV. So we get some new chapter titles in this book. Helene is no longer Helene. She's the Bloodshrike.
Which happened at the end of last book, right?
I think so. But I don't think I was prepared for it to carry over, or I don't think I remember that.
She's not even referred to at all in the exposition as Helene.
No, not even. And I think at one point, Elias starts to call her Helene, and she says something like, I'm the Bloodshrike. Same with Harper. So she's kind of like cast off that that identity in this book. And then by the end, Elias's chapter switched to the Soul Catcher instead of Elias, which was sad.
I saw it coming. Because Sabatier started sprinkling in Soul Catcher when referring to Elias in previous chapters. And then, so when the chapter title switched, I was like, oh yeah, this makes sense.
I didn't catch that. I wonder if any Nightbringer chapters will be titled with his name, which I do not remember. I just remember Beloved.
Mahera is his name.
There we go. Kelly remembers.
I like it. It's beautiful.
It is. I don't know how I feel about it being Beloved, but that's okay. All I could think of was Toni Morrison when I saw that, and I was like,
oh yeah, that's true.
But I haven't read that book, so.
Me either. Maybe that should definitely be on our reading list.
Something Sabatahir does really well is show her characters traveling through their world without losing the fast pace of the story.
Is this a travel narrative that you enjoyed?
It is. And I think it's because we get a lot of new places in this book, but we aren't with them for every step of the way. So obviously one of the critiques I had of the Grisha verse series was that we're traveling around and I got super bored. But this book will just like time jump 4 weeks ahead. And our characters are in a different place, but because we don't see them traveling, like, the pace really keeps going.
It's more like a film or a TV series in that way.
Yeah, it's more cinematic. And I think I enjoy that much more as a travel story than being with our characters as they're, like, camping out and, like, walking through the woods. I really enjoyed it, and I was still like very excited to see what happened next.
Before we end, it's time for real talk. Did reading this book make your perspective change in any way? Or did it make you interrogate a concept, system, or trend that you hadn't before? Do you want to start?
Sure. So I don't even remember when I wrote this down, but I wrote down at one point that Laia might be one of the most kind characters I've ever encountered in a book, despite all the terrible things that have happened to her. And I think Laia really shows that kindness can be a kind of strength, and maybe to like be more gracious towards people in your like day-to-day life. Like, we don't really know what people are going through, and Laia, even like through all the shit that like Helene has put her through, she's still like willing to help her, and like she really doesn't hold a grudge. And I know that's something I do myself. I like really hold a grudge. And so I don't know, something about Laia, I'm just like, she's just a very kind, like good person.
And I love that you said this, because something I noticed while reading this book, and I wrote it down, is that we see a lot of these storylines where people turn away from love as supposedly a sign of strength. And I think, obviously, we know that those narratives usually come full circle and then say that love is actually the ultimate form of strength. And Laia really is, epitomizes that for me.
Yeah. And I just really liked it. She just, like, I want to be her friend.
She just seemed like a wonderful friend.
Yeah. Like, she's a good person. I just like her a lot.
What this book pushed me to grapple with is what it means to feel feelings about people who have done bad shit, like the Nightbringer or Helene. Or Marcus, felt bad for him at the end. I mean, Elias has done a lot of bad shit, and we're all like on Elias's side. Also Cook.
Yes. I mean, I feel very bad for Cook. Like, she's done some terrible things, but sometimes I think we forget that people do terrible things because they're also in a terrible situation.
That's one of the things this book brought up for me. And that it's okay. Like, I didn't judge myself for feeling maybe empathy or good things about people who had done bad things.
And I think it's good to like question those feelings that we feel for people who did bad things, and like understand that maybe they're coming from a different place than we can even like imagine.
Yeah. And the importance of the backstory that seems to be like a through narrative in this series, I guess it just really expands the gray area and makes it important to embrace the complexity and just sit with the fact that, you know, people are, they're human too. Thanks for listening to JK It's Magic. We'll be back in 2 weeks for a discussion of Girls of Paper and Fire by Natasha Nyan, which might be the most beautiful cover I've seen in many years. And watch out for the occasional minisode about a range of fantasy adjacent topics. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at JKMagicPod. Post your tweet about the show using the hashtag CriticallyReading. Do you have an idea for a book we should add to our TBR? It's already like 100 books long, but why not add more? So email us at JKMagicPod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your suggestions.
Know a friend who would enjoy the podcast? Please spread the word. You can subscribe to JK It's Magic on Apple Podcasts, Google Play/podcast, and Stitcher. Finally, we'd really appreciate it if you would rate and review the show. It helps other people find us. JK It's Magic is recorded on lands traditionally belonging to Cheyenne, Ute, and Arapaho Native peoples. See you in a fortnight. Now we're going to talk about conflict, villains, and good versus eagle. Good versus eagle.
Cool. I saw an eagle on my way to your house.
Oh, really?
I saw a bald eagle.
A bald eagle?
Yes.
That's pretty cool. That's cool. So American. Very. Charlie saw an owl last night, like on one of the apartments next to ours.
So cool.
You know, I'm like, where's my Hogwarts letter?
Are you bringing it? Oh, okay, great.
Yeah, yeah, cool. I didn't get it, so I'm like, be the oldest student there. Just a 29-year-old Hogwarts student.
You can be a lifelong learner.
True.